And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I've known Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky since long before she was in public life, when she was an activist for seniors and consumers in Illinois. She has an extraordinary personal story about her transformation into an organizer and an activist and ultimately an office holder. She also has some pretty provocative things to say about President Trump and where we are today in our politics. But before we get to that conversation, I just want to remind you that next week we'll begin at our new home. The Axe Files will be moving to Luminary, an exciting new podcast platform where you can find all of your favorite podcasts. And for premium subscribers, you'll have access not just to the Axe Files, but dozens of great shows that will come to you ad-free. And if you go to luminary.link/theaxefiles before April 22nd, you can take advantage of a subscription discount for our listeners. Now here's that conversation with Jan Schakowsky. Jan Schakowsky, my great longtime friend, it's good to see you here. You know, one of the great blessings of doing this podcast is you think you know people, and then you do all this research just to get ready for the conversation, and you learn all kinds of things. And I was so fascinated by your family story, which is not unlike my own family story. But tell me about your family's journey to America.
Yeah. So neither of my parents was born in the United States. They came as children with their parents, both from Eastern Europe. I was not surprised when I found out my genealogy was 95% Eastern Europe, European Jewish. Mm-hmm. My mother family was from near Kiev, Russia at the time. My father from Russia at the time. And they both ended up in Chicago.
Because they experienced
persecution.
Must have been pogrom time.
Yeah, it was dangerous to be mm-hmm. Jewish. But I think, like immigrants from everywhere wanted to come for a better life. Now, they came through Canada. I don't know exactly what that means. If they,
my father as well was from Ukraine and came through Canada.
Yeah, and then we're settled by the Salvation Army in Chicago. My mother's family. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a peddler. And he would get up before dawn and get his horse and wagon, Teddy, and they would go get the big sacks of potatoes and vegetables, and he would schlep them up the alleys of Humboldt Park, where they lived.
They were on the northwest side of Chicago.
Uh-huh. And they had four children. The fourth was born in the United States, and a visiting nurse came, told my grandmother about birth control. So that was the end, number four. My mother was number two. My grandmother made all their clothes, and they lived a good life. All four children went to college. We would go there every single Sunday. And my first trip would be out to the barn, which of course is now the garage. I've driven by the house, and see Teddy,
the horse.
Teddy the horse, who was always a horse person. And my family, the adults, would be in the kitchen, talking Yiddish, gossiping away. And some of the early TVs were there, so I would, sit by the television. My grandmother would make French fries for the grandchildren, and yeah. it was great.
Yeah, we have sort of parallel lives. My grandmother, we'd go over to her house. I didn't understand what was being said. I'd watch TV, and she would make what she used to call hamburgers for me, but were just, it seemed like it was garlic just surrounded by some chopped meat, you know. She never quite got the whole American hamburger thing, down. So your folks, they must have, it must have been, if their experience was like many others, it was a struggle to get here, and they must have been determined to get to the U.S. Why?
Do you know, I don't know the story very well. I know the story better from my grandmother's youngest sister, who my great aunt, who lived with us, and did talk about how she had an aunt that was murdered on the doorstep, and nothing happened. There was no investigation
in the old country.
In the old country. She also talked about when she was a girl, she was really just a little bit older than my mother, that they'd have water on these yokes that people would carry around their necks and bring water to the homes. It was a difficult life that they lived. She never went to school because the girls did not go to school. Her brother did, and then he would come home, my great uncle, and teach her. So it was a really tough life. I don't know if there was a precipitating incident. Yeah. Oh, actually, there was. I believe that my great grandfather. It was the revolution. Around the revolution, and my great grandmother would help make bullets, and I don't know, there was some difference of political opinion in the family. Anyway, it was a dangerous place to be.
I only raise it because now you're involved in these debates about immigration, and it must inform your feelings about this to come from essentially. A refugee family.
Where refugees, immigrants, were part of the American story, and at least at that time, it really was possible to work hard and have a good life. And there wasn't this kind of, that I don't think that my parents and their families ever felt, this kind of sense of terrible discrimination and hatred, and you can't come here and America's full. Mm-hmm. Imagine, America's full. And so it makes me so angry. The idea, I've been down to the border, the separation of children from their parents, I think, is state-sponsored kidnapping and child abuse and deliberate, and someone should go to jail for that. I saw people in these cages. They were supposed to be a transit kind of center, so you're only supposed to spend a little while. It's just incomprehensible. I feel like if it was another country, that there'd be sanctions and condemnation, and the UN would get involved. I can't. It's just beyond imagination.
I want to continue on your story, but as long as we're here, what do you think's going to happen here? Because it really does seem like the president is putting his foot to the pedal on this. He basically cashiered the leadership of the Department of Homeland Security, who were already, you know, subject to a lot of criticism for the way this has been handled. But he fired them apparently because he didn't think they were tough enough.
No, and he told the Border Patrol and ICE down at the border, you don't have to obey the law. I will pardon you. A president that tells Americans that we're the badge of the United States of America to break the law. It's just unthinkable.
But he clearly sees a political advantage to this issue.
I you know, I wonder about that. You know, Republican women really don't like the idea of children being separated from their parents. It's appalling to them, and there are still thousands of children there. I don't know if he has not.
You
gone
may be
to
right. There were, I mean, there was a test case, which was the midterm election, and he torqued up this issue, as we all remember, in the weeks leading up to that election, and it didn't end well for him in these suburban communities.
Honestly, I think the cruelty, the meanness, and there's a lot of people that are like you and me who have an immigrant history, including two of his three wives and as the president's, the bitterness, the hatred, the language that he uses. I'm not sure that this is going to continue to appeal. I think it's to a shrinking minority of people who identify as Republicans.
But you believe that there is a humanitarian crisis. There is a steady flow of refugees from Central America, and there is this huge backlog.
The backlog, though, is also pretty deliberate. He wants to get rid of judges there. He doesn't want to. We could be hiring more judges. We certainly don't need to spend on the wall. So there are solutions.
Do you think he's doing
this
it to try and create and exacerbate the crisis for political reasons?
Yes, I think he definitely wants to say that this is, they're being encouraged to come here. Now, I mean, the whole thing, the fact that he wants to and has taken away funding for the countries that these people are fleeing from, fleeing for their lives, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and these are countries where he supports the dictators that are responsible and the chaos that's going on there. And then he slowed down the whole process. In some ways, he threatened to shut down the border, said it'd be for a year, but now it's so slowed down that people are sleeping under bridges, waiting to get a cross. So in some ways, he's accomplishing his goal of slowing down but I get that there's a humanitarian crisis there, but I think we can have an orderly process at the border. This is unnecessary.
You grew up in Rogers Park, which
is
on the north side of Chicago.
I did.
Your father was a salesman.
Yes, he sold furniture. He would sell to retailers. So he worked for one company, and he had a territory. And so he would go in Indiana, in the Chicago area, in Milwaukee.
And your mom was a Chicago public school teacher.
Yep.
And a union active in the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yes.
Was that a memory of yours? Was her activism something that was?
No, actually not. I mean, no, she was a staunch member, mm-hmm, of the union. It's not like she went to union meetings. But whenever the teachers were for something, the union was for something, she was for it. Being a teacher was her identity. That was her identity. She loved teaching. She taught first grade mostly, and she said it made her feel like God. She said the children would come in not knowing how to read, and suddenly this whole world would be open to them because she could teach them to read. And I mean, it was such a mission for her, and she was a teacher for as long as they let her be a teacher. She substituted until she couldn't anymore. They wouldn't let her, 75 years old.
Yeah. You know, that was an era when teaching was really exalted, and I wonder today about, we need teachers more than ever. We ask more of them because they have to deal with so many social ills that fall on a teacher's shoulders to try and remediate. But we don't treat teaching as important as the mission is. We hand our kids to these teachers and we ask them to shape their intellect and cultivate their capacities to make the most of their lives. But we don't treat that as an as a sort of exalted profession.
Oh no, I think that teachers are blamed for poor performance. I think that they are underpaid, constantly having to fight to be for the dignity of their work. And that's a serious problem that we have.
Although there's a mix, and you and I may have a disagreement on this. I don't know, because there are some splendid teachers, and there are bad teachers, just like everything else, everywhere else. And I think, you know, there should be sort of a grand bargain, and teachers should be paid what they're worth to society, which is enormous benefit, But there also ought to be standards and. You know, I know the debate is how you set those standards and what you do about it. But I don't think we have any disagreement over the fact that are the most essential people in our society.
And on average, they're spending a lot of money out of pocket in many places to provide just the basic supplies that kids need in school because they don't get them. The buildings, so many of them are not hospitable for learning. Many of them are falling apart. We need to renovate. So it's a very tough environment. And then, as you said, many times held responsible for the conditions from which their children come, come.
Right.
You know, poverty is such a terrible issue, and hunger and lack of employment for the kids' future and hope, and so it's very tough right now. Income inequality is really, I think, at the root.
Of so many things. We'll get to that.
Okay.
You went to the University of Illinois.
So I'm a public school kid. I mean, I went to Rogers School. It was very near my home. I remember some of the boys would come over at lunch to watch the World Series games that were on. And you could come home for lunch, which was awesome. and then I went to Sullivan High School, which at the time was, probably 98% white and 95% Jewish. And I am very connected to Sullivan High School now, which in Chicago Magazine was called Refugee High. And I spoke at a graduation there. I said, you know, I've stood where you're standing now, about 50 years ago, and told them the makeup of the school.
And I'm still standing.
What, pardon me?
And I'm still standing.
When I said, you know, 50 years ago, even the parents were gasping, you know, get this woman a chair. Anyway, and I said, we had to leave the sheltered halls of Sullivan High School to see the real world, and as it was changing, and look around you. There's some 70 languages spoken at Sullivan High School now. You're living in the real world right here.
You went to University of Illinois. You got married.
I was 20.
Yeah, that's young.
Yeah, I was very young.
And you had kids.
I was done with my kids at 24, yeah.
And you were living in the suburbs of Chicago. And your entry into activism was really an interesting one because as happens not infrequently, you confront something in your life that seems wrong, and you slide into activism in response to it. So tell me what happened.
Well, you know, it was an interesting time. The Vietnam War was raging. There were a lot of protests, but I was protesting in the grocery store. Had these two little kids, and a small group of women, six of us, got together because we wanted to know how old our food was. In those days, nothing had a sell-by expiration date, best-to-use-by date, nothing. You didn't know. They were clearly disguised by numbers, colors, dots.
Right.
The twist on the end of the bread could mean Monday or Tuesday, whatever the color of that twist was.
But that was known to the grocer, not to you.
Right. And so this group got together and modestly called ourselves National Consumers United.
Yeah.
We figured if we cared about this.
Might as well shoot big.
Yeah, but we assumed that certainly women, at least, because that's who mostly did the shopping.
Right.
We were ordinary housewives. And we first would push the stock boys against the shelves as they were rotating the shelves and putting the old stuff in front. And we were like detectives. We had the kids in the car. We would write down how they know and how the codes worked and how you could translate them. On the top of the tent on the milk, it was you add the outer two numbers for the month, and then the inner two numbers were the day of the month. So every single thing was disguised. You didn't know.
You could have been a code breaker for the CIA.
We translated hundreds of codes and actually put them in a book with a black cover, the NCU, National Consumers United, code book. And then we'd do store inspections, and we would put in the cart the out-of-date stuff. And we'd wheel it up to the store manager. And if we feared that they would just put that stuff back on the shelf, I admit to maybe poking a hole, in the package,
so
they wouldn't do that.
So, but the end result of it is that freshness dating became a norm.
Yes, and quickly. I mean, now I look back on it, it seemed like a long time, but about a year later, and we bought one share of stock, by the way, in Jewel and National, our local chains, and go to the shareholder meeting. And they, Jewel.
Yeah, they must have hated you.
Oh my gosh. They said, in fact, it got on the Huntley-Brinkley report, our going to the shareholder meeting for the National Tea Company, where the president of the company said, I don't know who you women are. You're either communists or spies for Jewel. Yeah.
We should tell those, there may be a few people who don't remember Huntley and Brinkley, but they were a big deal in their day.
This was national news.
The big NBC newscast. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this was national news.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jewel, the big chain here, started advertising, come to Jewel, we put freshness dates on our house brands. Oscar Mayer started putting dates on their vacuum pack meats. They had been a big offender. We were concerned because we didn't question the dates that they used. And infant formula and baby food, big offender. So that bothered us.
Yeah, well, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
That's life-threatening. So how did that whole experience change you?
So when I talk to young people, I say, you know, it changed me from an ordinary housewife to an ordinary housewife who could make a big change. You know, you could see it. I have to tell you, David, it still gives me a thrill sometimes. I'll stand in the dairy section of my grocery store, you know, watch people digging around and finding and looking at the date before they take. And it's tempting to go, moi, you know, I did that. But
does store security ever come by and say, ma'am, you're making the people nervous here. Look,
No. I don't like stalk them or anything. I just sort of watch.
Tell me how you, because, you know, I came to know you through the Illinois Public Action Council. How did you make the transition from activist housewife to full-time organizer?
Okay. So we, our little group, realized that we needed to learn how to organize because we got involved in the meat boycott in the 70s. Actually, we're almost pressured by the media to get it involved in it. What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. So we had a peanut butter and jelly lunch at the federal building calling on the feds to help boycott meat because the price had really skyrocketed. So good idea. Mm-hmm. Except that we were so far outnumbered by the press and the cameras at this event. We did our best, and we got about a dozen women to come and join us. And then I was doing an interview. They wanted me to do it while eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. That is life-threatening. And I realized I was being manipulated into doing this. This was not good. So we had seen in the news about the last of the Saul Alinsky groups, the Citizen Action Program, which was CAP, in Chicago. And they were turning out thousands of people against the Commonwealth Edison smokestacks and other issues like the Crosstown Expressway.
That was a proposed expressway that was defeated. The late Mayor Daley, it was one of the few places where he was thwarted.
And it was community organizing that did it, no question about it. And so we thought, how do they do that? How do they get so many ordinary people? We know people care about our interest, about what we're interested in. We sold about 25,000 of these books. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Just out of our basements. And, anyway. We contacted them. They were interested in us and our consumer activity. And I got involved in that organization and learning a lot about organizing. I went to the Midwest Academy, a school founded by Heather Booth, a great activist, to learn
and
more.
And graduate of the University of Chicago, I think.
But, yes, yeah. Yes, and was involved in all the student protests here. Mm-hmm. That's where she met her husband. We got some skills. Bob Creamer, who was working at CAP, decided to create a statewide organization. He hired myself and Jackie Kendall, who we were kind of partners in crime on all the consumer issues, to share a job. Always a bad idea, and women should know. If you're asked to do a job share, what he got really were two women that worked full-time for half-time pay.
Yeah.
We figured that out pretty quickly, but continued to work there to build what became the largest public interest organization in the state and working on lots of issues like getting the utility company Commonwealth Edison to stop shutting off people in the depth of winter. I worked a lot with senior citizens.
That was, you were on my radar screen for that. You became the chair. What was the group called?
The Illinois State Council of Senior Citizens, and I became the first executive director. And it was a lot of labor retirees. And I learned about courage from these people who were afraid of no one.
Yeah.
I mean,
was this very famous incident in which a elderly woman. You arranged a protest of Dan Rostenkowski, who was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, over this catastrophic health plan that was wanting, and there was a huge demonstration in his district, and he tried to drive away. And what happened?
Okay, so there were about 200 seniors in a room, and he agreed to only meet with some leaders. So the leaders were in a side room. And then we said, if Dan Rostenkowski, this was at the Copernicus Center, in the heart of his community, and there were a lot of people from the neighborhood, Lipinski, Lwakowski, I mean, all kinds of the ski names, Polish immigrant people or children of immigrants who knew his father, who knew him. So they wanted him just to come in and basically tip his hat to them before he left the building. So they said, well, as long as you don't yell and scream at him when he comes in, he'll do it. So we had a vote, and people finally agreed to not yell and scream. And then, as he was done with the small group meeting, the leaders meeting, we saw that he started to walk out of the building. Well, when the seniors realized he wasn't coming in to say hello, which would have been the end of it,
mm-hmm.
I never saw people move so, these older people move so fast. I thought they were going to get jammed at the door. And so first he's kind of strolling, and now he's kind of loping, and now he's kind of running, and they are keeping up with him.
And all this is on camera.
It's on camera. And he gets into the car, and so now he's in the car, and the seniors are around the car. And there's signs and a couple people sort of banging on the car. And this one woman who said later, she doesn't know what moved her, maybe it was God, she says, that said, go to that meeting. And she's standing in front of the car, and the driver made this terrible mistake of slowly moving the car, thinking she would leave, but no, she ends up on top of the car. Now, they are only about a couple feet apart in the windshield, you know? So she's saying, come out, and he's saying, go away, and this is all on camera. Finally, she's off the car, and the car pulls away and flips around. This is on Milwaukee Avenue. This is the heart of the community. And the seniors are blocking the street. They're running across the street. Somebody grabs onto the door handle, and the car pulls away. Seniors are like flipping off the car. That was a moment.
Let me ask you, you've been in politics. You've been an office holder now for, I think, 28 years. In your professional opinion, how does that rank among disasters?
It was huge. First of all, I came to Congress with sort of this card in hand, which is watch out because Schakowsky can get the seniors to chase you. if they can chase Dan Rostenkowski, his powerful leader of the House Ways and Means Committee, that was like part of his name.
Yes.
Then, you know, it's a problem. So
that is, by the way, actually such a great thing about a democratic society, because
exactly.
As powerful as he was in Washington, he still had to come back and face his constituents, and it actually had impact.
Impact.
Yeah.
The bill was repealed. When have you heard about a bill repealed?
Yeah.
The problem was that it really was a problematic bill. The catastrophic health care plan didn't have anything in long-term care. It charged union members were going to end up actually paying more because they had better retirement. It was not well done, which he never admitted to the end.
You went to the legislature. You spent
in Illinois, right?
Yeah, you spent about eight years.
Eight years there.
Yeah, and what did you learn as a legislator on the other side, as someone who had answered to constituents who had to deal with the realities of governance, which are much more complicated than advocating for change. What did you learn there?
You know what? To this day, I'm really an organizer, and I understand that very often, if you can mobilize people, you can actually move a legislative agenda. But you're right. It really prepared me for being in Washington, and I see that all the time. People who have served in general assemblies, who have served in local government, who really understand the process, I think are much more prepared for coming into the United States Congress. For one thing, I think you learn that it takes a while to get things done. It's not going to happen overnight, and often not just in one session of Congress. And I learned about a lot about working with other legislators. But I had one real surprise, because one session when a number of people Democrats were retiring, I went to them and I said, okay, now you're not going to be here. You can help me vote. You can cast a vote right now for this issue that will make utility prices lower. And they said, well, you know, Jan, I'm interviewing for a lot of jobs. And I don't think I can do that. That was a
eye-opening.
Yeah, it was eye-opening and quite disappointing.
You ran for Congress, and you were in a very hotly contested primary. One of the other candidates was a guy named J.B. Pritzker, who is now governor of Illinois.
I never hesitate when we're together and I introduce him and I like him so very much.
Yes.
Just to say that, you know, 20 years ago I beat him for Congress, but now I'm wholeheartedly supporting him for governor.
How different was it in 20 years ago when you arrived in the Congress for a woman in Congress?
Well, let me tell you, on the way in the primary, because the other candidate, there were three of us in the Democratic primary. Howard Carroll, who had been a state senator for 20 years, something like that, and was considered a machine candidate. None of us differed much, really, on the issues. But I remember going to the Plumbers Hall, and the president at the time of the Plumbers literally patted me on the head and said it just wasn't my turn. And, you know, he was supporting Howie because Howie had paid his dues, and, you know, it was fair. And I just, as pleasantly as I could, said, well, let's talk after the primary. And, of course, we did, and he did, and, you know, I had the labor support in that race.
Yeah. You get to the House. How different was it then?
Well, of course, there were far fewer women, but there were some powerful women. Nancy Pelosi was there.
That was just about when she was moving up.
Pretty soon she was going to be elected the whip, first the whip, right. And and I became very close to, and, you know, made sure I did hang out with the really wonderful women who had been there for a long time. But it certainly was, you know, extremely male-dominated. But, you know, when you have a force of nature like Nancy Pelosi, it's not like she just let things slide by. Rosa DeLauro at that time was running and lost by one vote for the caucus chairman. So, you know, we had self-confident and prominent women. Nita Lowey told me the story that when she had fairly recently gotten a bill passed that required that for medical studies that they had to that they were only using at the time male rats, much less only men, in studying heart disease, for instance. And she had to get that change, that there was some gender consideration when we looked at healthcare issues. I didn't feel, even though we were fewer at the time, that we would necessarily, it was more my seniority, which, you know, I didn't have much. Although even now, it's different for freshmen who expect that they will be powerful on the first day.
You knew that wasn't the case when you went, because you'd been a legislator. I have to ask you, because earlier you talked about the pace of legislating and so on. There is a great impatience in the country for big solutions, for answers, and a growing sense that you can't really arrive at that through cooperation because of the polarization that we've seen, that you just have to overrun the other side. But that's not really how democracy works, is it? I mean,
well, let me say this. I think the impatience and the sense of urgency that we see right now with a number of people in the freshman class is healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I get it. And I've talked to constituent young people about the environment. I had a group come to see me about the Green New Deal, which I'm sponsoring. I mean, I'm one of the co-sponsors of. That was initiated by AOC. Imagine a young person being you know, new person, just know her by her. But I want to say that what this young girl said to me, and it was so precious. She said, "Congresswoman, you don't understand. I've been working on this issue for 6 months," and it was so precious. But what I realized, as a percentage of her lifetime, it was a short time. So, the sense of urgency backing up things like our work on the environment. I'm not talking, the Green New Deal is a vision statement, but we passed a bill now that's out of our committee just last week. Energy and Commerce. That says that the United States of America must be part of the Paris Accord. Pretty modest bill, but we're working on emission standards and all kinds of things. I think with a new urgency brought by the new members, of course, by the circumstances as well, that require, I think, a new sense. I think Donald Trump has stimulated that too, the sense of urgency about getting money out of politics, about voting rights, which are at mm-hmm. risk in so many places. We passed H.R. 1, which we call it the For the People, but it's really a broad democracy-saving kind of mm-hmm. Agenda.
Which won't get taken up by the Senate.
You know, Nancy, I just read an interview she did, is not willing to accept that because she says that public sentiment is everything. She quotes Abraham Lincoln. And if we can get enough people, you know, in the House of Representatives, we had 30 Republicans join us in a broadened reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. We even had some Republicans join us in universal background checks on guns. And there's a lot of pressure on the Senate to that.
Lately, you mentioned AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is sort of a phenomenon. I mean, she came out of nowhere, defeated a senior member of your leadership to get elected, and it has a kind of social media genius for communicating. I think she has 3.5 million followers.
Second only to Donald Trump.
Yeah. Is there any resentment among those of you who have toiled in the vineyards there for years about this young woman who's now sort of supplanted? I mean, you know, other than Pelosi herself, is probably now the most talked about member of the House.
She is the most talked about. But
partly because
also,
Republicans want to talk about her, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she has been a lightning rod for the Republicans, and particularly the far-right Republicans. No, I don't sense that. Partly because of her. She's very nice, and she's working. She's a good team player on mm-hmm. a lot of things, on most things. And
a lot of people were impressed by her questioning of Michael Cohen in that
She's smart.
Hearing. Yeah.
She's really smart. And does her homework. And while she has sponsored this Green New Deal, she understands that the work is going to be done in committees. And Speaker Pelosi actually created a select committee on climate. So she gets that it's going to be happening in that way. She continues to use her voice in caucus, which I love, because for a lot of sessions that I've been there, freshmen were loath to speak, and now they're standing up in caucus all the time and talking about what they care about. You know, the Republicans and the media wants to really plumb divisions. That's the story that they love. But I have to tell you, if you look at the votes that we've taken, and we've taken a number of them on important issues, it's overwhelming. We may lose one or two or three Democrats. So there's a lot of cohesion in our mm-hmm. caucus. Part of it is the genius of Nancy Pelosi, though.
Ilhan Omar is another mm-hmm. member, new member, who's become a target. And most recently, because of a truncated quote from a speech that she was making. The point she was making was that these terrorists attacked the World Trade Center, and that became a pretext for tarring an entire community.
And it's true.
I think it is true. But it seems pretty clear. And she, earlier, she made a very controversial statement about that essentially was aimed at AIPAC and the Jewish community in terms of influencing politics in Israel. And that became very difficult. She's another person who seems to be someone who the president, Republican Party, want to lift up. And not for positive reason.
No, we're going to see, and I'm sure we're going to see more of it. He's not letting go on Representative Omar.
Have you spoken with her?
Oh, many times. Many. She personally apologized to me on the way that she framed the issue of the influence of Jewish money, which the Republicans have done big time, bigger time than she has done. And I felt and she came to me personally as well as publicly apologizing for that. But you know, she covers her head, which makes the image, I think, for the people that Donald Trump wants to incite, a better picture. She's actually African American Muslim. And now she's getting death threats every day. And the Capitol Police have to be involved, and security has become a really big issue for her because of this president, Ilhan Omar is not a threat to the United States of America. She ran for Congress. She took the oath of office, as we all do, and is trying to serve her community and learning along the way, I think, the kinds of things. She spent years in a refugee camp.
Yeah, she's a refugee.
She is.
And we had this discussion at the beginning. No one loves this country more than people who understand the lack of the freedoms that we have and have experienced the kinds of things that she experienced. It's striking to me that, I feel I'm a first generation American. One of the reasons I feel so strongly about this country is I know what it meant to my father and his family to find refuge here and find a life and be able to build a life. And it's one of the things that makes me put my hand over my heart and when the national anthem is played, because it means something to me. And so,
exactly.
It's painful. So, it's painful to see her depicted as she's been.
No, and I put out a tweet that I stand with her, that what the president is doing is absolutely wrong.
Talk about the Democratic Party broadly. We have a presidential race going on now, and with more candidates than you could fit in this room, and growing. There is this concern that has been expressed. I don't particularly share it, but that that this will be such a vituperative process that at the end of the day, the party will be divided in the general election against Trump. First of all, what do you see in these candidates? You haven't endorsed a candidate.
No.
Do you intend to endorse a candidate?
Oh, I don't know. Down the road, maybe. Mm-hmm. But certainly not right now. What I sense when I talk to people, that the number one criteria is who's going to beat Donald Trump. Now, people will have different opinions on
I always wonder about that, because I know people are saying that. I'm sure it's meaningful, but it's also true that people tend to rationalize their choice. So if they choose a candidate Like the people who are supporting Bernie Sanders believe he's the guy who can beat Donald Trump. The people who support Biden believe he's the guy who can support Donald Trump, who can beat Donald Trump. People who are supporting Kamala Harris may believe she's the person who can beat Donald
Trump.
Mayor Pete.
From South Bend, Indiana.
Yes. Right. Yes. Who's been sort of the.
He's third in the polls now.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think for one thing, the shiny new object is moves forward. It's like AOC, you know, maybe even the Chicago mayoral election. New means change, a breath of fresh air. But I think, in addition, he's been almost flawless, I think.
Yeah.
When he's been questioned about why he's running, his vision for America.
He's very, very good. He's very talented. He's a friend of mine. I mean, I know him well. I would say to him, as I said to everyone else, the thing about this process is when you raise the bar for yourself by performing well, you have to clear the higher bar. And so tests will come down the line, and it'll be interesting to see how he contends with that. One of the tests, of course, is building a national campaign,
right,
which is no small matter. But let me ask you a question on this, on this issue of age. Do you talk a lot about Speaker Pelosi, who's been a phenomenon, really. You know, there was a lot of question as to she was an issue in the campaign. Would she get reelected? Those of us who've watched her over the years handle numerous counts, vote counts in that institution, would not have bet against her. But and of course she prevailed, and she has been very, very strong in dealing with the president and holding your caucus together. That said, and she's nearing her 80th birthday. That said, there is this issue. You've got candidates, Bernie Sanders, Vice President Biden, who apparently is going to enter, who are in that same age bracket. Should that be an issue of concern?
I think it's one element. I really do think it is. You've been in the White House. You've seen Barack Obama's hair grow white or gray.
I did, yes.
I mean, it's different. In terms of stresses than being even the Speaker of the House, which makes her the most powerful woman in American history. But it's still not President of the United States, and decisions about, life and death. And I think it's a factor. Do you?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah,
I do. You know, I say this respectfully, but yeah. I sat in the office next to the president for 2 years, and I saw what came to that desk serially. I don't know how it operates now and how decisions are made now, and I can't speak to that.
No one seems
I puzzle about that often. But I saw what the president had to deal with. And as he used to say, nothing easy comes to this desk. You know,
That's right.
Things that come to this desk are the things nobody else has been able to resolve,
right?
And a lot of them had grave implications of life and death,
exactly.
implications for the economy, implications for the world. And you know, one of the things that a president has to balance on his or her shoulders is that burden, and you know, the shoulders are a little less sturdy. As one, I can say this as someone who's moving up myself, you know, you're not the same. I've had this discussion with, not in the context of these candidates, but, you know, I remember President Obama saying to me, I'm not the same person that I was when I came here in terms of, my physical. And he worked out all the time, and it's draining. But he said, you know, my experience, the experience you gain offsets that.
Seen that in really every president. If you look at their first inaugural dress, and then you look as they leave office. I mean, it is really, really a stressful job. So I do think that that it's a factor. On the other hand, you know, there is the element of experience, both of running campaigns and being in campaigns. So you know, we'll see how that comes out. But I consider it as. You know, it may not be the best thing to have someone of that age.
Are there candidates who you worry about in terms of not being able to beat Donald Trump?
I think it's too early to tell. I think they're going to have to show their stuff over the first debate is already in June. I mean, it's coming up pretty quickly to see how they. How they respond and what their thinking is and what their vision is, I don't know yet. I don't think we know yet.
Yeah, but on the whole, it sounds like you feel like the primary is. I do, but that the primary is a healthy exercise.
I do. I don't know. You may have seen there was a front page story in the. New York Times about it never hurts to run for president. I mean, you know, it may advance.
Well, a number of your colleagues apparently. I mean, Eric Swalwell got in. Seth Moulton's talking about running. John Delaney, who just left the House, is running. It's everybody's jumping in the pool.
Right. And you know, then they may be running really for vice president or for. You know, just making themselves more, giving themselves more power, which I think it does when you decide to run for president. So who knows is really who's going to get to the finish line. No, I was sorry that Sherrod Brown didn't run. I thought he would be a good
fellow
candidate.
Fellow Midwesterner.
But you got to have it. I mean, you really have to want to be president of the United States. And he also mentioned, and you do have to make those decisions about sending people off potentially to die. I mean, these are really, really have to weigh heavy on a shoulder.
I'll tell you something. The day that Obama got elected, my most memorable moment was going to see him after he was declared the winner. And walking in the room, and it was almost palpable. You could see... these lines in his face as he contemplated what he was about to enter, the country in the midst of two wars, a gathering financial and economic crisis.
Oh my gosh!
And I saw that tension in his face, and I really didn't see it leave until January 20th of 2017 when he left office. It was always there. There were light moments. But you knew that it was his constant companion, and it's a very, very difficult. You have to have a very strong constitution.
Well, one would think you have to have a strong constitution and worry about the things that he worried about. We have a very different president right now, and I'm afraid of him. I think he's a very, very sick person, and I worry that when cornered, this man could do something catastrophic.
Michael Cohen told told the Intel Committee, I think this may have been in the private session that leaked out, that he was concerned that the president wouldn't accept the results of an election, that he
think
would
about
resist.
That. I know.
And is that a reasonable concern?
I'm more concerned, you know, he really does have the nuclear codes in his pocket, and we do really have nuclear weapons on hair trigger, you know, that they could go off. And who's around him that would stop it if the ultimate distraction was on his mind? He has said, of course, that during the campaign, that why do we have so many if we don't use them? He's trying to get money right now for low-yield nuclear weapons. I'm really worried about that.
You think he would go that far?
I think he is so needy, and that every day he tries to fill this deep hole in himself. It's all about that. And feeling validated and powerful and the winner. I do. And I've actually talked to some pretty high-level people who have been in the administration and before, and I say, well, who around him? Are there? Can I be confident that there are people around him who would stop him? And I never got a really solid, you don't worry about that.
That was one of the concerns when General Mattis left the
exactly
Defense Department. Look, I can't end on, we've got to end,
okay,
but I don't want to end on that note.
No.
And just, it should be noted, because you are kind of a pioneer in many ways for women in politics. That there are four women running for president of the United States now.
And I want to say, and there's not been like this big, oh, wow, the glass ceiling. I think Hillary Clinton, in many ways, did break the glass ceiling to the point that the fact that there are four women running for president is not this huge deal that people talk about all the time.
Four women, three people of color, and you mentioned Mayor Pete, who's an openly gay man,
right.
That is not the focus of attention
no.
of his candidacy. It does speak to the arc of progress, social progress in this country. So, Jan Schakowsky, I could talk to you for hours. It's great to be with you, as always. Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
Being here.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.